This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Technology is no stranger to the classroom. In 1922, Thomas Edison predicted that motion pictures would one day replace textbooks. Not long thereafter, similar claims were made for radio and later television. In the 1990s, the cutting edge was the PC and the Internet.
I want to build a bridge to the 21st century where we expand opportunity through education, where computers are as much a part of the classroom as blackboards, where highly trained teachers demand peak performance from our students, where every 8-year-old can point to a book and say, I can read that all by myself.
Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich echoed President Clinton's statements, and current President George W. Bush has continued to push for computers in every classroom. Since 1990, the promise of better education with computers has cost an estimated $70 billion. Journalist Todd Oppenheimer argues that much of that money was a waste. After years of research, he's written a book called The Flickering Mind, The False Promise of Technology in the Classroom and How Learning Can Be Saved. Later in the program, we'll venture into the mean, though virtual, streets of online games where, amid sword fights and laser battles, politics and economics have broken out. But first, computers in the classroom. How has your child's school incorporated computers into daily lessons? We especially want to hear from teachers, principals, school administrators this hour about whether they think the benefits outweigh the costs. The number here in Washington, D.C. is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Todd Oppenheimer joins us now from the studios of member station KALW in San Francisco. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks very much.
The title of your book, explain to us, how have computers been a false promise?
Well, they continue to promise much, much more than they've delivered. They have not only two main problems. They create such a shortcut mentality and such a consumer mentality in the classroom that you bypass many of the layered steps that makes for good education and good psychological development. And the other main problem is they've been a tremendous drain on schools that can't afford fancy machines like this and can't keep up with the constant updates that technology requires.
When we mentioned the film strips of Thomas Edison, radio, TV, all of those have been heralded as aids to education, indeed sometimes as panaceas. What's the track record for technology in the classroom, and has it ever worked?
Well, the track record is very bad. Not only just on obvious levels, none of that machinery ever really penetrated the classroom. The television was probably the one that we invested in most heavily in the 60s. President Johnson, President Kennedy, vigorous, expensive campaigns. Corporate foundations, the Ford Foundation, put a lot of money into that. And as we all know, television's never really made it too far into the classroom. In fairness, the computer is, of course, much, much more robustly used. But the studies of what the effects have been on achievement, and there are many hundreds of those studies, the benefits are just not there.
And before my colleagues in public radio call in, I will ask you about the accomplishments of distance learning using radio sub-channels that's very popular in rural areas in the country.
Yeah, the distance learning has some interesting pluses and minuses. For students who are truly stranded, it's a great savior. But it's overused, and this is the problem with technology. It's constantly overused. It's being used in schools that don't need it, where there are regular classes available, and some of these students are complaining about feeling isolated, not getting some of the experiences that their peers are getting when they sit with teachers and actually discuss books and many other topics.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you arguing that computers actually have a negative effect on the learning process, or just that they get in the way and devour resources better spent elsewhere?
I'm arguing both things. It's important to note there are exceptions to this. There are schools and there are occasionally classes in every school where computers are being used wisely and intelligently, and great things are occurring. And they are pointed out in the book. My argument is, what is the case most of the time in most schools, mm-hmm. in particular in the average schools and in the vast number of public schools, and in particular in the poor schools that really cannot afford to support a program like this? In general, computers work best in schools that have got a lot of money, where there's a small class, so the teachers don't have to deal with a lot of problems. They've got well-paid and well-trained maintenance staff to attend to problems, to train the teachers, and this kind of thing. And as you can imagine, that is not the case in most schools in the country. So
somebody could argue that everything works better in a school with a lot of money and small classes.
Absolutely. But given that we are not funding education properly, you got to set your priorities. And for us to make computers a priority when we're neglecting basic things like well-paid teachers, science and art classes, music. Music classes are some of the programs that are constantly cut to make room for technology. And if you want to look at the academic research, there's much more robust studies that learning how to play a musical instrument actually physically develops the brain in ways that computers never could.
Well, some would argue that the computer itself is an instrument of sorts and one all of us need if we're going to succeed in the modern world of the 21st century.
True enough. Yes, mastery of the computers is increasingly important. The problem is it doesn't take a lot to learn it. One of the most esteemed experts in this field, Joe Weizenbaum from MIT, no less, said he could teach his students all the computer skills they would need for successful work at MIT in a summer. Employers, I mean, this is the main argument fueling this whole campaign, as you point out, is if you're going to get jobs in the future, you need these computer skills. Well, if you talk to employers, and I talk to a range of them in many fields, they are not so feverish about this. They don't care about that. They realize, number one, that they can teach the basic computer skills that they need from their employees very easily. And if they can't do it, they can go out and get it in an evening class quite quickly. More important, what they really need from these students is a deep background knowledge, the ability to communicate, to reason, to be reliable, to write, to figure, to be able to estimate in their head. And these are skills that the schools are just not developing. One of my favorite quotes on this comes from the Information Technology Association of America, which represents employers in a range of fields that use technology. And in a report that they distributed, they said, you want to get a job in high technology? You want to get a job solving problems in technology? Know something about the problems that need to be solved.
There's a lot of focus on computer literacy as a pretty functional something we all need in life to survive, whether it's required to get a job or not. And that goes back to the computer programs do go out of date and you get new ones, but the point and click skills are pretty much the same.
Yeah, I mean, computer literacy is important, and I think any high school would be derelict if they graduated their students without some basic knowledge of what the software programs of the day are. And that can be done in a semester or two. So there's no need to rush into this in the third, fourth, and fifth grade, let alone the fifth or sixth grade. More important, what the high schools should be doing with their students is turning them out with a deep knowledge of how modern electronic technology works. How do you make your own software program? How do you take apart a computer and build a circuit board? That's really what they should be doing in the high school computer classes, and very few are doing so.
Let's get some listeners involved. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And we'll begin with Deborah, who joins us from North Tonawanda in New York.
Hi. First of all, it's a thrill to be on your program,
thank you.
I think you do a wonderful job. And I disagree with most of what your speaker is saying. I teach sixth grade, and I have to say that because I've been teaching long enough to have been in the classroom before we had the access to computers, what I am seeing students able to accomplish now is absolutely phenomenal. And watching the growth in their ability, because we also have a program in our elementary schools, and we are very limited in our funding. We're a city school district. We have a total of 40 computers in our building, 20 of which are for keyboarding. So rather than the old-style typewriters, they're learning their keyboarding on a low-priced computer. But in terms of what they're doing in the technology end of it, we're competing with all the things you spoke about, with television, with video games, with arcade games. And our students now, because of access to the Internet and because of what they are able to do, I can make my classroom a much more exciting place because I can utilize all that technology. and the kids' keyboarding skills are improving. We just did an activity where the students were studying ancient Egypt, and the students were able to go on the internet. They were able to take pictures, put them into a document, able to give credit to the website where they gleaned that information, so that they're learning about plagiarism and how they have to give credit. They're learning how to edit because they're using word processing instead of handwriting, so they're more enthusiastic about making changes. I could just go on about the benefits.
Todd Oppenheimer?
Yeah. Well, obviously I haven't seen your classroom, and it may well be very good. It sounds not bad, but there's very few things you just mentioned that can't be done with just a book and some discussion and passing around a book, even if if you don't have a number of copies.
Just
hear me out. Potentially a couple of magazines. So a normal old-fashioned library will accomplish most of what you said. Secondly, and again, no disrespect to you, you may have a very good program going there, but I heard tales like you just told so many times from so many teachers, and when I would go to visit those classes, very often most of the time was being spent on sort of mastering the computer graphics, figuring out how to get something off the internet, fixing some technical crash, doing it up in some PowerPoint presentation, and afterwards, when there was some discussion about what the content of the issues were, that discussion was pretty thin. A lot of times the students didn't even know how to answer the most basic questions. So without visiting your class, I don't think it can be evaluated. But
I invite you to come to my school and not only visit my classroom, but any classroom that's working with a technology. And I appreciate what you're saying.
I guess my point is, everything you describe tends to foster what I saw in school after school, which is kind of a gee whiz, wow mentality. And people are all excited about what they can do with the technology and how they can put this material together with the technology. And that's what they're excited about. When I would go to lower tech schools that were pretty good, they were excited about the material, the discussion, the knowledge. They would go further with it because the materials they're working with are simpler. And so I would see 5th and 6th grade students in much simpler schools going way further than you just described, talking about the actual issues they're learning.
Deborah?
Okay. I still disagree with you. I think that because of the access, not only are my lesson plans much more thorough in the materials that I can incorporate into my activities and my instruction, but in addition to that, the students who at home are encouraged to watch very highly technological games that they're playing, they come to school and they want me to entertain them. And the competition for everything that's out there and making them excited about school, we have a website that we take advantage of. I keep bookmarks, that it's a free program out there for teachers. And I bookmark all the topics and all of the chapters that we use in school. So if we're talking about Hatshepsut, for example, and we're talking about trade along the Nile River, my students can go home and access that website under I Keep Bookmarks for my classroom, and they can actually be linked to all of the websites that we're working on in the classroom. So students who have the technology or students who can go to our public library and get onto the internet don't have to spend hours searching for items, because we've already centralized all of the materials for Rome and for Egypt and for Greece, so that the students have access to it. It's amazing what they bring into class and how our discussions in class are so much better.
Deborah, I'm afraid we're running out of time in the segment, but I wanted to thank you very much for the call. I assume you're able to listen to us today because it's a snow day there.
No, actually, it wasn't a snow day. We had a teacher conference day in our school because we're at a middle school. Our day ended at 2:40. So I was on my way home, and I happened to be listening.
Well, snow day perhaps tomorrow.
We're brave and strong up here in the cold hinterland.
Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more with Todd Oppenheimer, the author of The Flickering Mind, when we come back from the break. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation. TOTN at NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with Todd Oppenheimer, who's the journalist who's the author of a new book called The Flickering Mind. It addresses the issues of computers in the classroom. And Todd, just before the break, we were listening to Deborah, a teacher from New York State. And obviously, you disputed some of the things that she was going on, you said was going on in her classroom. But you could clearly hear an awful lot of excitement there. And isn't that at least one thing that we weren't hearing an awful lot of wows from the classroom on any subject 20 years ago?
That's true, and I'm glad she called, because it was a good display of what you see often. And let's assume that it's a display of some of the best uses of using technology. Let's assume everything she said is true. Now, I must say, I had those kinds of conversations for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I went to as many of those kinds of classes as I could. 75% to 85% of the time, I would be so disappointed when I got there. The content of the discussion was much thinner than the teacher thought. Most teachers are in a fog of delusion about what's actually occurring. And the actual work is so thin compared to a decent low-tech school where the teachers are keeping things simpler and are sticking to the issues at hand. But let's just assume what she said is right. A couple of issues come up here. The excitement you see is more often than not a consumer kind of excitement. That's not what you want. One of my findings in doing this book is the culture of the technology industry is diametrically opposed from the culture of schools. The technology industry is about this kind of excitement. It's about gee whiz and sizzle and the latest new thing and getting things quickly and conveniently and making things easier. School is about something quite different. It's about taking your time, reflecting, slowing it down, not skipping steps, learning to work hard for what you produce. One of the things about technology is it lets you put together what looks like a finished report incredibly quickly. You can borrow material from all kinds of places and slap it in there, cut and paste, throw in some graphics. And teachers usually don't have the capability to really deduce that and see what's gone wrong and see what's been skipped. So there's that. Number two, and this is much more important, it goes to some of the deeper issues in the book. She said it quite well. She said, look, I have to compete with all this media at home, so this is how I do it. That's not the way you want schools competing with that kind of media. The important thing at home, and right around the year she was talking about, I think she's dealt with 6th or 7th grades, that is about the time that students are start to be capable of dealing with the internet. But it's a little dicey then, particularly in the younger years. You'll see teachers doing the same kind of thing, and that's way too early. Those are the years when every child development specialist will point out when students' skills, their internal, their senses, need to be built and developed. And there's some very interesting studies coming out now from Germany that are quantifying, based on decades of research with 4,000 subjects, that are quantifying the decline in the sensitivity of our senses. As this one example, they found that 16 years ago, people were able to distinguish 300,000 different sounds, and today that's about 180,000. And for children, it's down to about 100,000. And what's interesting is that's enough to sort of get a feel for pop music, but it's not enough to hear everything in classical music.
Hmm.
That's very telling. That's very, very telling. So this is not, so you don't want to compete with all this, and the reason for this is because of excessive media stimulus. So you don't compete with media stimulus by providing more of it in the schools. You compete with it by letting the schools be a sanctuary from that kind of bombardment.
Let's get some more listeners involved and talk to Marcus, and he's with us from St. Louis, Missouri.
How are you?
Okay.
Good. I just wanted to make a comment, if I might, about, give me a sec. I tend to agree with the panelists there. I don't want to overstate it, though. I think that, on the one hand, we have to own up to the fact that our children are being wired somewhat differently and they have a relationship with media that we didn't, or at least that I didn't, and that, my parents before me and so on and so forth. On the second hand, though, I do agree that I think that we have to be careful. I think that we get so caught up in what it can do, and that is what media can do, or computers and technology, without paying attention to the fact that we may be very well trumping some very important development stages and skills, and you know, or expensing those things. For instance, I've aware of at least one report that says that literacy gets expensed. We can't read the computer screen in the same way that we read books, and so we have some problems there. Also, too, there's something about the grappling with the occasional hitting and missing and with things and learning that we sometimes miss when we use certain kinds of technology. So I just wanted to get a little feedback on that if I could.
Todd Oppenheimer?
Well, I think I agree with what he said, and I think that if you think about the notion of building blocks, I think everybody agrees that building blocks, learning the fundamentals in anything is important. Anybody can look at their own profession or their own love. Basketball, sports is a great metaphor. You're not going to send somebody into the NBA right away. They have to learn how to dribble and shoot baskets and how to use their body and so on and so on. And this is the problem with exposing youngsters to computer technology so quickly. It's like going from A to Z right away. It's like giving a kid a car at age 10. We all know that you don't do that. Or giving him, a $10,000 a week allowance. It's too much too soon. So my argument is not to get computers out of schools altogether. There's a place for them. It's to just scale it way back and keep them out of the younger grades and then introduce them slowly and minimally, starting in junior high school and then more in high school and using them differently in high school than the way we do now. So that they can start to build up their sense of the world from the ground up and not skip this enormous time when they build the capacities and the imagination. The irony here is that in terms of being able to compete in tomorrow's workplace, what's needed most is a very active imagination and sophisticated math skills and a broad knowledge base. Even business guru, that fellow, the older man, I can't think of it. It'll come to me. Peter Drucker points this out, who's one of the most widely regarded soothsayers about what the business of the future needs. And so you've got to start. Those are the skills you need to build that take years and years and years of development. Computer skills take a few months. That's it. So why are we knocking out what builds those internal skills in the early years and replacing them with something that they could do in a few months when they're older?
Marcus, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay. And let's go quickly to Dan. And Dan's with us from Macomb, Illinois.
Hi, Neil. How you doing?
Okay.
Love your show.
Thank
Good
you.
Job. I'm a broadcasting major myself right now, and as a full-time student, I also have a full-time job, and it's really hard to juggle, and what's saving me right now is distance learning and internet courses, and I have never had a bad experience with one. I mean, they're very well put together from the professors on that end, and I think that it's a really important and a very useful tool for lots of students. And it's almost, I wish, I'm a little older now, mm-hmm. but I wish that I would have had the knowledge, computer training in high school, which I didn't have. It was just, I graduated early 90s, and it hadn't quite hit the boom yet. But I think it's just an inevitable force and factor, and it's, in this instance, it's very useful and can just, have just amazing positive impacts on students and in the workforce too, and it's almost like I'm trying to. I have a 5-year-old too, and we're trying to teach her as much about the computer and also with keeping integrity in mind and making it useful, not just a game. And I think if that happens in schools, what happens outside the classroom, you're not going to be able to really stop that. But I think if schools kind of assert themselves to make sure that it is just useful and formidable, and that it should be fully embraced by schools, if not, pushed even harder. And I'll take my comment off the air because I got to get back to work.
And Dan, good luck with your program.
Thank you very much.
Okay, appreciate it. Todd Oppenheimer, any quick response to that?
Yeah, the distance learning phenomenon is interesting. And actually, I've been going to be writing about that for the New York Times in April. Particularly the phenomenon of PhD, people getting PhDs, that kind of degree online. Mm-hmm. Clearly, it's a great thing for students who really have no other ability to go to school. Either they live far away or they've got jobs they can't abandon.
A lot of them are homeschooled also.
Right. That's a subject in itself. Mm-hmm. But the dilemma, though, is and some of those students, if they really can do it, they show tremendous motivation. It takes a huge amount of self-discipline. The dropout rates in distance learning programs are immense, as you can imagine, much, much more so than traditional schools. But those who really stay the course, those are very, very self-disciplined people. The problem, though, is that they sometimes give in areas where you really want personal interaction, you know, psychology, teaching, even philosophy, where it's the personal give and take face-to-face that really makes the experience. So there's a real concern out there that there's a declining standards of what a true educational degree is supposed to say. What is this credential supposed to say? So there's a certain dumbing down of credentials that is happening at the same time of opening up opportunity. So there's a concern there.
Well, joining us now by phone from her office in Folsom, California, is Marina Light, director of the Center for Digital Education, a research and advisory institute for technology companies and educators. And good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much.
I know you've been listening for a little while, Marina. How do you respond to Todd Oppenheimer's argument that computers in the classroom really don't aid in the learning process, indeed get in the way?
Well, I think that during the course of the program this afternoon, we've been talking a lot about the technology itself, which seems to be where the conversation goes a lot. I think the missing element is really to talk about who are the students today and how is it that they learn best and what's important to them and how do they want to learn. We're in a somewhat a painful time of transformation right now in public education in this country. Mr. Oppenheimer talked about Peter Drucker, and indeed he's a real visionary and speaks about what these times are. And there's enormous tension between holding on to what our traditional values and sense of public education is and what's it going to take to sort of modernize and update those with the vast advancements that technology has offered us. So when I talk about who are the students today, this generation, students, kids born between 1982 and the year 2000, they're called the millennial generation.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually the largest generation ever. They represent 36% of our total U.S. population. It's about representing about 100 million children. And they have grown up in a world that's always had technology. We've all heard the reference about, you know, the ATM machine and how it really revolutionized the banking experience. And children today never grew up without the ATM machine or the internet or computers. And they do want to learn with technology. They want to learn with each other. They want to learn online, offline. They want to be able to have the flexibility to learn at their own pace. These are all statistics coming out from various research groups on who the millennial generation is.
We're talking about computers in the classroom with Marina Light of the Center for Digital Education and with Todd Oppenheimer, whose new book is The Flickering Mind, The False Promise of Technology in the Classroom and How Learning Can Be Saved. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I wanted both of you to respond to this email we got from David Modrell in Independence, Missouri. I used to teach middle school technology education. My kids in a poorer rural district had wonderful problem-solving skills, but my kids in an affluent urban district who had computers and were very book smart did not have good problem-solving skills. The differences were stark and clear. I don't think your guest, he's speaking of Mr. Oppenheimer here, I don't think your guest is advocating getting rid of computers, rather that they're a tool and not an end in themselves. Computers and programs are constantly changing. Kids and adults learn the systems they need when they need them. Marina Light?
Well, he's absolutely right. No one's going to say that having computers in the classroom is going to replace core subjects, the real development of learning skills. Mr. Oppenheimer talked earlier about what it is that what students need to be competitive in the workforce for the future. And whereas that does include technology skills, and he's right when he says, you know, people need to know how to keyboard and this and that, but really 21st century skills is sort of the phrase that's circulating amongst educators now. 21st century skills, I agree with the email, do equate to learning skills, the ability to problem solve, to analyze data, to be able to work with each other, communicate, collaborate. And I don't think Mr. Oppenheimer and I would disagree on that.
Yet those kids who had those skills were the ones without the computers.
Yes, I mean, I suppose it's debatable. I've been in classrooms all around the country where I've had a very different experience from Mr. Oppenheimer and where you see kids engaged in learning much longer. by being online. But the most important thing to remember about education is that we have to be able to teach students to be able to apply and be able to do things with what it is that they learn. And computers as a tool are very much enable that.
Todd Oppenheimer?
You know, there's an old phrase from the Army that is the title of one of my final chapters in the book, which is, keep it simple, stupid. And, you know, the Army, having to fight wars, they've understand what makes things work for big institutions where you deal with a number of people of a variety of skill levels, and how to deal with the average person. And I found this very telling. It's why I titled the chapter that book that. When you keep things simple, you open up possibilities for personal complexity. And the problem is the computers have come into these classrooms and so complicated the environment, nobody can get more than an inch deep in most classes. And I saw this in the highest tech schools. Most of the schools I visited in this book, I visited many where they were very bad, and I could have shot ducks in a pond by listing all those, but I stuck to the schools that are famous for being high tech. And the scenes there are discouraging time and again. So this is, you know, it's constantly a fantasy that we can get this right. We haven't, we never have, and I don't think there's a great likelihood that we're going to in most schools. Now, in the process, there's a couple of issues we haven't even talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Technology brings in the industry to schools in a way that the business community has never had access before. They've got huge new access, and they're controlling the show in these schools because the schools and educators are relatively innocent when it comes to business ethics. And business people are coming in with their mind priority being selling. So schools are being taken for a ride in a lot of ways that we have yet to appreciate. I have a piece coming out in The Nation next week that details some of the scandals that have been perfpetrated on the schools as they've done these wiring contracts to get the poor schools wired.
And we're running out of time, so if you could move it along quickly.
Sure. The poor schools have been one of the primary victims here, and will become the subject of hearings on Capitol Hill in the next few months. They've inflated costs on these schools tremendously, 300% and 400%. So that's one scandal, and there's others that are deeper than that in terms of how schools and companies misuse research in selling their wares to schools.
And you can find out more about Todd Oppenheimer's opinions in his new book, The Flickering Mind, The False Promise of Technology in the Classroom, and How Learning Can Be Saved. He was with us from studios of member station KALW in San Francisco. Thanks very much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Enjoyed it.
And Marina Light, we appreciate your time today as well.
Thank you very much.
Marina Light is director for the Center of Digital Education, and she was with us from her office in Folsom, California. When we come back from the break, virtual communities are generating some big business these days, and academics are flocking to study the ramifications of places like SimCity. If you participate in these online communities, we'd like to hear from you. 800-989-8255. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.